Okay, I'm going to get started. I hope the mic setting is fine. Better? Okay. No, too much talk. So, I did post a homework on the class web page. If you look at the discussion board, it's got a link in it, or whichever way you want to go. Yeah. It's on the class web page. Where's the class web page? Google my name. Okay. Everything's findable by Google. It's also linked to the syllabus. There's plenty of ways you can find it. I'm going to recap. What we talked about... I did not plug this thing in. So I'm just redoing this. I shouldn't need to. That processes are composed of CPU bursts and I/O bursts. That is, if I let a process run and make it the only process in the entire system, it's going to spend some time doing CPU, it's going to spend some time doing I/O. The length of the CPU burst depends on the actual program. And it could be infinite if you've got an infinite loop in the program, which in that loop, it's not doing any input-output. It's just calculating some numbers. But we have no, as in operating systems, we have no control over how long or short the CPU burst is. How long is the I/O burst depends upon the I/O operation the program started and the mechanisms like disks or printers or if you're asking for user input, I want to read a line from the screen, it's going to sit there until the user enters and presses enter or whatever. So this is also highly variable on the mechanisms and the humans you're interacting with. Non-preemptive scheduling says you pick a process to run only if it's in the CPU burst or it's starting a CPU burst, and then you let it run till its CPU burst ends. How does the operating system know that your CPU burst has ended? Because you do a system call to do some I/O. That's when your CPU burst has ended. That is, of course, not at all a practical way of doing scheduling. No practical scheduler does non-preemptive scheduling. It is a way of getting started to talk about scheduling. That what if we did non-preemptive? Why wouldn't we do it? Because if there's an infinite loop, if a process is malicious or whatever, it can gum up the whole thing because you leave that process alone forever if it's going to run forever. So that and many other things says this is not the way to do it. However, and in non-preemptive, we talked about three kinds of schedulers, FIFO, SJF, and priority. FIFO, completely fair, nice, poor performance in the average case. Very poor performance in the worst case, etc. Because of our measure of turnaround time, which I went over and talked about how to calculate them. SJF will always be the best scheduler. But it's not implementable, and it suffers from this stuff called starvation. This is actually a takeaway into all areas of operating systems. There are many, many algorithms which can be done FIFO. They just don't work well. FIFO is fair, but performance and fairness somehow doesn't jive with each other. So if you want performance, you don't be fair. SJF is the extreme. It's very unfair, so it performs the best. And priority means you can do any way you choose. So it's the most general. Priority covers FIFO, SJF, and many other things. So I left it kind of open. Depending on how you set priorities, you can get any form of scheduling. But they're all non-preemptive in this case. So next step is, of course, preemptive scheduling. But before I go to preemptive scheduling, while looking at my notes and stuff, I realized I somehow have not properly covered the issue of system calls. I did go through interrupt handling and context switching, and I should have continued and done the system calls bit. So I'm going to talk about system calls. Now, notice when I was talking about context switching, process P1 is running. An interrupt makes this process change the PC to the interrupt handler. And then it continues running here. Then the RTI goes back to some other process P2. Okay? The first takeaway is that a timer interrupt happened. We switched the program counter so that the process comes here. While this process is running, it is still the user process belonging to somebody, Joe, that's running here. There is no such thing as a kernel process. Kernel work is being done by a user process. That's running over here. And it so happens that an RTI sends it to P2. And at this point, we say this process is not P1, it's P2. But it's the same thread because there's only one CPU. It's just sequentially going through various things. And this execution and this execution we will charge to P1. This execution we'll charge to P2. If P2 comes back in the kernel, P2 executes in the kernel. Now, fine, as long as you, any questions with that. So the kernel execution is just time stolen from user processes to execute kernel code. There's nothing in the kernel that's running. It just steals processes. System calls are almost the same thing but different. In the code itself, you can put the INT instruction for Intel, SWI for something else. Different CPUs have different names for these instructions. It's a software interrupt. That is, the moment you execute that, the CPU believes that it got an interrupt. And this software interrupt will have a code as an argument, and that will be looked up in the interrupt vector. And there'll be a handler here that executes the call. So let's say this is to Unix, Linux has a write system call. If you call the write system call, you're trying to write something to disk. If you call that system call, it'll go into the kernel. And here will be opcodes And these opcodes are privileged. So your mode bit has changed. You are executing on behalf of P1 some code in the kernel that is writing to disk. Then at the end here, it could do an RTI, but it shouldn't because the disk writing is not over. It may want to wait for the disk to actually write, flush to disk. Okay? There's some buffering. You may not want to do that, but let's assume you want the disk completion signal to happen, and then you continue with P1. So here, you will put something like a and then let's assume that the wait for disk is over, so you do something else, and then you do an RTI, which will bring you back to here. But this execution of the thing, now wait, this is much harder than it looks like. How do I wait? Well, you don't wait. This is your I.O. burst. That's when you have to tell the scheduler, switch me out. Okay, so the wait there is no such thing as wait. Wait is a routine which calls the scheduler and says, I need to wait. The scheduler takes your PCB out of the ready queue and does a context switch to some other PCB in the ready queue. And so the RTI in the scheduler will run away to something else. And you will be hanging forever because you're not in the ready queue. Eventually, a disk interrupt handler will put P1 back in the ready queue. So that happens asynchronously. There's no code for this right here. But that code is in the disk interrupt handler, which picks out which process was waiting and puts that in the ready queue. Eventually, the scheduler will pick it up. Okay? Okay. So that's how input-output works. That's how all system calls work. All system calls are a software interrupt that takes you to the kernel, does the function. Some of these system calls return immediately, that's fine. Some of these system calls call wait, which tells the scheduler to flip the CPU burst to end the CPU burst and start an I.O. burst. The end of the I.O. burst is done with a disk interrupt handler or a keyboard interrupt handler or a mouse interrupt handler. Some other interrupt handler does that. So it gets a little not very smooth programming here. It's fragmented into places. But that brings us to an interesting observation. So if this is the kernel, and here is the software interrupt routine, process P1 might enter the software interrupt, run till here, get context switched out. So that causes process P2 to start running and may cause the same system call. And here we have another process executing the same code before this green process has finished executing the code. And what's worse is even while this guy is executing system call code, we could get a timer interrupt, and which can cause another context switch, which causes P3 to start executing from here and start executing here before that black thread has even finished. Now, this sort of bizarre behavior does not happen in regular code. You have one thread of control that executes. Here you're saying anywhere in the kernel, an execution can suddenly stop because of a wait instruction or because of a timer interrupt or because of something else, and we just abandon this execution, start up something else which is executing user code, but that user code jumps back into the kernel and starts executing kernel code which isn't done yet. And these pieces of code all have access to global memory, so they could be trampling over one another, and you'll get terrible results. So this is a problem that's inherent in every operating system kernel. It is also shows up in threads programming. Some way down the line, we will talk about how to program in such a crazy environment, because this is ripe for incorrect execution, and we cannot have incorrect execution. So there's a word for it. It's called reentrant code. A piece of code that is executed, halfway executed by some process, and then another bit of halfway executed by some other process, and a third process also comes in there, or executes something else which messes with the same variables. These things are entering the same routine or function over and over again. And they're called reentrant code. Reentrant code must be able to tolerate reentrant behavior without causing errors in execution. And this happens, this was first noted when people started building the old primitive multitasking operating systems. And that's where all the techniques of writing reentrant code, which today is used for user-level threaded code, was invented. And that's one of the hardest part of understanding concurrency. Concurrency is not something that you encounter in single-threaded code. You encounter in multi-threaded code, or you always encounter in operating systems, even if the operating system is running a single core. Okay? And that's due to the system calls and how they work. So we'll talk about this after we finish scheduling. And this is both fun as well as not so fun. Any questions about system calls and reentrancy? Code doesn't belong to processes. In fact, this part that I'm explaining is code in the kernel. It's a shared kernel. Everybody has access to it because they can issue a system call and jump in there. So you jump in there. While you're in there, a context switch happens, I jump in there. So now we are both executing the same piece of code. Now it's not done one by one, that you finish the call to the subroutine, then I will call the subroutine. You're in the middle of updating variables within a subroutine, and I start executing the subroutine. And that subroutine is shared because it's kernel code.
it's a context switch, there's a timer, right?
Context switch could be a timer, context switch could be due to a wait. So there's a variety of reasons why there could be a context switch. So very old operating systems said you should not have a context switch inside the kernel. Well, those days are gone. All kernels are preemptible. That means you can switch it out anytime. Okay? So now we couple this with preemptive scheduling, and things get messier. In preemptive scheduling, there is one very well known and pretty much covers everything scheduler called round robin. All schedulers that use preemptive, which is all operating systems today use preemptive, and they're all based off of the round robin scheduler, tweaks to the round robin scheduler. So the round robin scheduler in its basic form says, you have a ready queue of processes ready to run, and this is a queue. It is a FIFO queue. And I'm drawing the head here and the tail here. And I take the head and I run. So I pick up one process from a ready queue, which is a FIFO queue. I put it in the running state, let it use the CPU. I context switch to it in the kernel by the scheduler. And the scheduler will wait by setting a timer to see if this process ends its CPU burst by calling a system call which says write to disk or read from terminal or whatever, or it just exits, because it calls the exit routine, or it has run for enough time. So we give it a slice of time. That's where time slicing comes from. We give it a certain amount of time, which we call a time quanta. If the process runs for that time quanta, we'll stop it. So if this CPU bursts end, we go to IO queue. If it terminates, we go to exit queue. And if time quanta expires, move to ready. Then I move it to ready queue. So I will take the scheduler will context switch this, put the PCB at the end, pull another PCB out, context switch the two processes so that the second process in the ready queue is running and the first process goes to the end of the ready queue. Okay? That's all. Yeah. Is the introduction of time quanta, is the introduction of a feature where a running process gets stopped by a scheduler. In non-preemptive, a running process is never stopped, which is a bad idea. So every time you run, you're given a time quanta, and if you're not done by then, you're thrown back. So that way I can say that all of these guys will get kind of a fair share at running. Everything will be progressing at a certain pace. Okay? And you visualize that this queue is just going round. So that's why it's called round robin. Any questions? So time slicing, round robin, fair, all of you get one quanta. You can get less than one quanta if you don't want to run anymore. And then also you go to the IO queue, you come back to the bottom of the ready queue, and eventually you run. So, do real life schedulers do this? Yes, they do. However, this one's kind of not very good because it has this FIFO component in there. We don't like FIFO. So before I say we don't like FIFO, I should say why we don't like FIFO. So that's a little harder to see here, but what's going on is, let's say my ready queue consists of P5 is now running. After P5, P4 will run, then P3 will run. These two processes are processes which is going to execute for a very long time. Of course, they will not be allowed to execute for more than one time quanta, but they are processes that are doing a lot of processing, so they will definitely expire their time quanta. Whereas interactive processes, which is very common in desktop systems rather, your browser is an interactive process, your word processor is an interactive process, your Excel spreadsheet is an interactive process, that they hardly execute. They paint the screen, wait for you to type in stuff, and then does something. And the faster, the quicker they respond to your clicks or enters or whatever, the more respect you have for your computer. So I want, as an operating systems designer, I want these guys to like be immediate response. But in this case, these two will slow it down. They are going to interfere from the CPU going here. Why don't we do this guy first? We don't know how to yet. But they will interfere. Not only that, they will get time. They will get a timeout because the time quantas will expire. Then they'll come back and will later suck up time from some other interactive process. So all interactive processes as well as long-running processes get stuffed in the same queue, and the interactive processes get delayed because of these long-running processes soaking up time quanta. I don't want that. Okay? Which leads us to, let's say we slightly modify the round robin scheme, and we say, can we have round robin with multiple queues? And that's called a multi-level queue. Firstly, we somehow segregate the processes into large CPU bursts. Let's just talk about two queues instead of four. But the other two are like medium. So here at the top queue, you've got the processes with tiny bits of CPU bursts. They're mostly CPU bursts with long I/O bursts. Those processes I put on top. The bottom processes are processes that do number crunching. Lots of CPU bursts going on, you know, Bitcoin mining or something like that. And then I tell my scheduler, only pick up processes from the top queue. Ignore the rest. If there's nothing there, go down one. If there is nothing in the two top queues, go down to the third. And finally, to do anything here, all of the above must be empty. If that was possible, then we can say, like, look, anything that a human being tries to do, the programs will be extremely responsive. You only communicate with one program, and that's always going to run the moment you hit enter or do a mouse click. And you will get high priority service, and even if your CPU is not very fast or there's lots of things running, you will notice that it's pretty responsive system. It's a way of tricking, good marketing strategy. Okay? So, but does that make sense? And can you see problems with this scheme?
How does it know?
And you'd said?
And large processes may never run.
How does it know? That is a problem. In some cases, we can probably put some labels on certain types of applications or whatever. But OS people have this thing about, we are not going to know anything about applications. We will run the applications the best we can. So we don't know. So we can't use this. Secondly, as you pointed out, only the top people will run. These will not. So there are two problems. Firstly, only the top people will run is partially true, because what has been seen in reality is that these tiny things that have to run quickly, they get out quickly. So they, most of the time, the upper queues are empty, so the lower queues get some service. But it still could be that it goes up to here and never goes down there. So there's starvation. And both are problems with multi-level queues. Can we fix these? Okay. Did I do that? No. No, this is working. Okay. So an attempt to kind of do something smarter is called the multi-level feedback queue. And this is close to what a lot of operating systems use. Again, we have multi-level queues. And I'll draw one I/O queue. Actually, there's more. in this system, we don't know which process is big CPU, which process is small CPU. We also will try to do some starvation management, but doesn't do a very good job of starvation management. All new processes that we don't know anything about go to the top queue. Any process that has finished I/O goes to the top queue for their next CPU burst. So every time a CPU burst starts on a per CPU burst strategy, you're going to the top queue. In the top queue, if you run and you quickly end your CPU burst and go to the I/O queue, you will return to the top queue. And you can stay there as long as your CPU bursts are small. If your CPU bursts are a little larger than the time quantum will expire and you will go to the next level queue. Okay? And then again, after you've gone to the next level queue, the CPU will only service the top queue. The top queue gets emptied very quickly. So then we'll go to the next level queue. We'll pick up a process from there and give it a time quanta of its remaining CPU burst. If it goes over that time quanta again, it's brought back here. So on a per CPU basis, we are trying to let the past predict the future. If you consumed a CPU burst, we think you're going to consume a lot more. If you consume two CPU bursts, you're not a very nice person. Okay? So we keep demoting you based on the feedback we receive about you, based on how much CPU bursts, how many consecutive time quanta you've consumed in your current CPU burst. But if you end up finishing your CPU burst, we'll give you a new lease on life by putting you at the top. So it's a much more dynamic scheme. Think about it. How well is it at starvation? Not very, because we could have things coming down here, and then we can add on something called aging. Aging is a method which is kind of an ad hoc add-on, that if there are old things sitting here, move them up. They're not getting service. It'll cause a reduction in performance, but we have to be somewhat fair. Round robin is very fair. It runs through everything. Fair is not very nice. So we are making things unfair by moving people down, and then sometimes we've got to make it more fair. Yeah.
Is that amount of time, is it determined by the hardware or the software?
It's determined by the operating system. It can be determined by a variety of things. You can choose different time quanta for different queues also. So typically this one may have a time quanta of 1 unit, 2 units, 3 units. What's a unit? The smallest unit is the timer interval. Timer interval is also set by software. It's somewhere, I think it's normally set to 20 milliseconds or 10 milliseconds. So, no, 20 milliseconds, 50. Somewhere between 20 and 50 milliseconds. 50 milliseconds is 1/20th of a second. And the smaller you set the time quanta, should we set the time quanta to small or large? Actually, what does small mean? That's another. How small is small? But let's go with a little bit of intuition here. Should we set the time quanta to less than a millisecond, tiny pieces of time, or larger amounts, or even a second or 10 seconds? What's the effect of the time quanta? Think about round robin. That's the simplest. Don't worry about these feedback cues. You're changing your time quanta using a round robin. What will give you better performance or whatever? Will there be any difference? Yeah. Yes. And why?
Because if it's short, then the interactive processes
can be
faster. But if it's larger, then those large processes
can get it done in one shot rather than keep... So short time quanta will elongate longer processes, and the shorter processes will get to it quicker. You're right. Response time will be better. I didn't talk about response time, but I will in a minute. So yes, the shorter time, the smaller it is, the quickly everything will be looked at. And quicker you will get, everybody will get service. So why don't we just make it small? Very small, infinitesimally small.
Nothing would get done.
Why? So if I expand it, after every time quanta is over, I'm jumping to the next process. That's not a zero time thing. There is an overhead in context switching. And this context switch time is dead time, non-productive time. And then you're giving it one time quanta. So the ratio of this to this matters. If your context switch time and your time quanta is approximately the same, you'll be wasting 50% of your CPU power doing nothing. So the context switch time better be at least 1/10 or much less than 1/10 of your quantum. And that determines how small you can make it. But even at that point, a small time quanta will make certain processes run slower, will still waste some time. So what do we do about it? So go back to feedback queues and have larger time quantas for longer running processes, smaller time quantum for interactive processes. So that's just fine-tuning. It's an engineering problem. Okay? Response time is something we talk about as human beings. What's the response? The computer responds fast. Response time is really not a very important thing from a throughput point of view. Response time is very important from a human point of view. And it's not very well defined. It's kind of defined by if a process enters the ready queue, how long does it sit there before it actually starts running on the CPU? Because there's no other, actually it should be till it starts dancing on the screen or something, but we have no way of kind of quantifying that. So we say before it starts running on the CPU. Now you can see there are two things I can tweak to make response time good. One is make your time quanta short. So response time will be the average number of So it's a multiplication on how many processes ahead of you and the time quanta. They'll all be done within that many time quanta. Okay? So make time quanta short, you'll get better response time. Or make the length of the ready queue small. Yes.
Is time quanta always a fixed value, or does it change based on the processes? Like how?
Since it's a software controlled value, it's up to the designer of the operating system to dynamically change it. However, they just leave it fixed. But they do change time quanta on the queue, on the priority. So lower it is, the higher the time quanta. They save on context switching overhead. But if I'm looking at a queue, I have a time quanta. I'll assume it's fixed for that queue. This is going to be my response time. So can I reduce the number of processes in that queue? And response time is really for interactive processes. So they're in the top queue. I want to reduce the number of things in the top queue. And that's where multi-level feedback queues push things down, reduces the number of processes on the top queue. The smallest time quanta is for the top queue. And that's how we fine-tune good response time. And that's how real schedulers work. Okay, I'll take some questions. This is a round robin, multi-level queue, multi-level feedback queue. Yeah. Ready queue.
Ready queue.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, why did I do that? I didn't draw it out of a hat, so why did I do this?
Multiplying something?
Yeah. Yeah.
You multiply the average length of the ready queue by the quantity.
Mm-hmm. Anybody?
Does it round robin? It'll go through all the previous ones.
All the previous ones. If something comes in and the length is really one higher than this, so I could have done a minus one there, but I didn't. So if there are three processes ahead of you, it may be as bad as three people running full-time quanta. Probably they won't run full-time quanta, but this is like a upper bound on what your response time will be. And if there's 10 processes ahead of you, you'll have to wait for 10 time quanta. Yeah.
So we have a bunch of different factors for how we decide which is going to get put into the run queue, like red queue and stuff. So how do we logically
the answer is you cannot. That's why people have this thing about my scheduler is better than yours. Okay. Point is you have to give interactive processes quicker service, and as well as not completely drive out the long-running ones. And it would be very, very dependent on what is your job mix. Really, how many processes are you running? On a desktop computer, nothing's going on. So we're mainly talking, but we still need a scheduler. On a server, depends. Is it a web server? Is it a database server? So the job mixes, amount of CPU time, total amount of CPU time used by all the processes over a period versus total amount of I/O time and network time will, this ratio will have an effect. This ratio has nothing to do with the scheduler. The scheduler is just allocating things. So it's a difficult juggling game. So how do people do this? Window scheduler is pretty much the simplest one of the bag of tricks we use. It's a 32-level multi-level feedback queue where a process's priority starts at one is the lowest priority and 15 is the highest priority for most processes. So when you start a process, it'll start at 15, and as it takes up CPU time, it'll move to lower queues. So think of it as 15 queues. There is nothing up here. There is a terminology, not very correct, that some things are called real time. Real time means completely, so it's two words. Real time can mean actual real time systems. In a normal scheduler like Windows or Linux, real time processes are those processes which, for whatever reason, need supernatural powers. Okay? So you've got to label real time processes by being root and designate certain programs as real time, and they will get the most priority over anybody. So there may be nothing or very few of these, and they will be not running most of the time. So we ignore this, it has 15 queues, and it'll start decreasing the priority as the CPU burst gets larger and larger. So reasonably straightforward, simplistic way of doing things. Then there is the Unix scheduler. Unix scheduler is no longer around. This is the old Unix system, not Linux. Okay? That follows a very similar thing. They just use different terminology. The Unix scheduler is called the NICE scheduler. The NICE scheduler has a NICE level, and the higher the NICE level, the lower the priority, because those people who want to run at low priority are NICE processes. Okay? So you can nice a process by lowering its priority. There is a re-nice command, or you can bring it to... Now, again, 0 through 19 is for ordinary processes. Anything below 0 is one of these super real-time processes. So nothing typically goes below 0. 0 is for interactive. And if you nice a process, you purposely increase its thing and it becomes a background process that doesn't get much attention. Okay? And then there is a plethora of Linux schedulers. Linux schedulers are a little strange. I'll explain this instead of trying. Linux scheduler 2.4 is one which says there will be an epoch. In an epoch, everybody gets one-time quanta. And if you're done with one-time quanta, we'll throw you out till the next epoch. In each epoch, you get one time quanta. But processes have different time quanta based on their classes and some magic formulas of assigning time quantas. So this is a variable time quanta situation. Okay. So that's also an older scheduler. Now, the point is, does it make any difference? Is this any better than the Unix scheduler? There's no way of telling. Maybe I'll spend a little bit of time on measuring performance of schedulers, but the net answer is we have no idea. Now, the Linux 2.6 scheduler is also kind of like the epoch scheduler. 2.6 has two kinds of schedulers, the older one and the newer one. This has 140 queues, essentially 40 queues. They separate tasks into active and expired. If you've used one quanta, you go to expired, and there's some priority calculation. To me, it seems like just the epoch scheduler, but they made a few changes in the name. The one that I don't understand Okay, I don't understand this or why. They call it a red-black tree. A red-black tree is a kind of a data structure which is a balanced binary tree. And the key, you need a key to balance the binary tree. The key is that will not work well. They must be updating the key. Okay, so all processes are arranged in this red-black tree where it's a binary tree with the left side lower CPU usage, right side higher CPU usage. So if you just traverse the length of the tree, you get to a process which has the lowest CPU usage. You pick that one, run it, and then as its CPU usage goes up, you push it back somewhere else. All this rebalancing and searching can be done in all n log n time. And there must be some way of redoing the keys, because otherwise there will be starvation. Okay? I can't see why this is better, why do we need so much work, and how many processes, active processes do you have in a system? It's generally around 2 to 4, and you want to have balanced trees to handle 4 processes. But the idea is that if you have 100 processors and 1,000 processes, maybe this will be a good idea. And it's definitely not fair. So that's a wrong word to use. Can't spell queuing. Q U E U E.
ing. Scheduler evaluation. So why do we think one scheduler is better than the other? So I'll do a quick run through of these techniques, and I can't point to anything which says that will tell you. First, you can do traces. Traces means that you take a computer center, data center, something like that, and actually instrument the operating systems that you're using. That is, every time there's a context switch, every time there's a CPU burst or whatever, the operating system records a log of everything that happened as far as the scheduler is concerned. And you let it run for a few days, and then, or maybe months, and then you calculate all these stages, these traces. It's like a big data problem. And now you've got a trace of how things behaved, how every process behaved. Now you take out from these traces all the scheduler decisions. You extract each individual process, how long it's running. Now you feed this data into a simulator that runs it according to the rules of some other scheduler. No, traces can be used like if you have scheduler A running here, scheduler B running there. You can compare the two from traces. Which one did a better CPU utilization, interactive, whatever, whatever. But they're not running the exact same programs. You wouldn't take in a major production house and run multiple copies of the same thing. You would run whatever you need to run. And the needs will change, although you can say average need on this data center is the same as that data center, if you believe that. And you take this and you just run two kinds of schedulers. But the schedulers also affect their own behavior. I don't know how to explain this. The schedules will change because of the algorithms in the scheduler, but the algorithms in the scheduler are dynamic, so the changes it makes affects itself. So anyway, traces may give you some insight. Queuing models are forget it, it's complete theory. It says there's an arrival rate, there's a standard deviation, there's a service rate, there is so many queues. Can we analytically solve this problem? It's been touted a lot to model operating systems, it's never been successful. Simulation, on the other hand, says you have two ways of doing it. One is you collect these traces and then write a program that emulates the scheduler, goes like, okay, I'll pick process one and I'll run it for a large time quanta. Why? Because I think large time quantas are better. So I give it three time quantas. Then I take process two, I know how much CPU burst it is because all the traces are there, and I give it some other time quanta. And I come up with an algorithm, and I come up with, let's say, an implementation of the Linux scheduler, I come up with an implementation of the Windows scheduler, and I come up with my fantastic algorithm, and then I compare what's the turnaround time, response time, etc., etc. But again, you're using somewhat of a synthetic workload, because that workload is not what you're going to be working on. That's somebody's workload for 3 days when they were doing something. That workload generation itself is work which perturbed the scheduler. So how can you trust that this simulation which says Windows is better than Linux actually says Windows is better? For this particular perturbed situation, it's better than Linux. So you can't draw any generic conclusion from it. Okay, go ahead and implement it and run it. You'll have to instrument it. You'll have to keep a track of what exactly is going on, which, if you take that out, it'll be a different scheduler than putting it in. So there's too much perturbation and too much data here based on a particular run rather than How does it perform overall? How does it perform overall? Cannot be measured, predicted, or argued, other than obvious things, like non-preemptive is a bad idea. Preemptive is better. Round robin may not be as good as a multi-level feedback queue. How do I know? It's kind of intuition. Okay? Yeah, that's all I have on scheduling. I'll take questions. I can start on something new. Or not. Yeah.
This was one from like a little bit back with like the Windows scheduler you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Like with like the 32 feedback or like the 32 queues.
Mm-hmm. 16 for regular processes, which is essentially that counts.
Yeah, so like for the real-time ones, does that mean that they get like larger time quanta, or does that mean that they
get faster service? They're at in the multi-level feedback queues, 32 queues. You can only enter in the Windows scheduler the high queues if you're branded as real-time, which needs a particular setting in the operating system to designate certain apps as real-time.
So does that mean that they're like bigger tests, or that they're like ones that...
It's up to the administrator to designate which one's real-time. So Windows doesn't care. If you claim this is real-time, it'll put it there, but you need administrative privileges to make that claim. Yeah.
So on those regular queues in the Windows from the 1 to 15, is that just in the ready queues? Or that
that's 15 ready queues in the multi-level feedback queue system. And which is higher, 1501? I think 15 is higher. So it'll pull from 15 only, and it'll pull from 14 if it's 15 is empty. Oh. And then it'll put it back in a lower queue if it expires time. So it's the same multi-level feedback queue idea. So complex schedulers are not necessarily better, I think. Now, is the Windows scheduler, which is simplistic multi-level feedback queue, any poorer? And there's nothing to go by that it's poorer. Windows is slower, but that's a microkernel design. That's a whole different story on why Windows is slower. Okay, anybody else have questions? What am I supposed to do next? Kernel threads. Oh no, compile link load. Oh, that's okay. So I'm just going to give you a preview. The compile link load is kind of a boring topic, but I want you to know about it. It's like, how do programs that are written as multiple we'll stick to C because Java, etc., are not compiled. It's a whole different story. But then the Java virtual machine is written in C. How do you compile, link with libraries, load into memory that you don't know when you're compiling? What is link editing? What is address resolution, dynamic relocation, the whole thing about addresses, opcodes? How does it actually work? How do programs run that started its life as a C code file or multiple files? Then we will talk about threads. Okay?
I'm going to go to the first one. I'm going to look for you.